People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
This yesterday, billionaire Richard Branson went to space on one of his Virgin Galactic rockets. That's right, the flight went more than 50 miles high to the edge of space. Southwest heard and was like, big deal, we did that last week when one of our pilots fell asleep. It was a pretty cool moment. I was a little surprised by that one part. Did you see this? Watch this.
3, 2, 1, release, release, release. Ignition. Good rocket motor burn. Everything's looking really good and stable.
Just a little. Come on. You don't need to do that.
No need.
That's funny. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Tuesday, July 13th. Hi, Willie. Good to have you back. We've missed you.
Thanks, guys. Good to be back with you. I had a little eye injury last week. I wish I could say I was on a sunny beach, but thanks to a good dermatologist and ophthalmologist, I'm here, not fully recovered, but as close as I can get. So it's good to be back.
Well, we are glad to have you. Among the many stories we're following this morning, quote, they are getting laughed out of court. That is what the Republican Party's top lawyer said in real time about the election fraud claims by former President Trump's legal team. And this morning, a federal judge in Michigan is calling the claims from Trump-allied lawyers fantastical. We'll talk about the new efforts to hold the former president and his backers accountable for spreading those lies about the election. Plus, a dramatic escalation in the battle over voting rights in Texas. As Texas Democrats flee the state, they're now in Washington to lobby Congress to take federal action. We're also following the new warning about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine amid a new surge in COVID cases. And the polar bear does it again. The Mets slugger Pete Alonso wins his second straight home run derby. Okay.
Wow, Willie, he just completely dominated this process, this competition. A lot of talk, obviously, about Otani beforehand, but this was all Pete Alonso's night.
Yeah, it was in Denver, too, with that thin air, the Coors effect, they call it, Coors Field. Those balls just launching, absolutely launching out of there. Otani was fun against Juan Soto in the first round, but you're right, Joe. Pete Alonso, the New York Mets slugger, repeating. Getting that giant spinning necklace for a consecutive year. He's into it. He's into it.
I need one of those. I love
it. He likes that necklace. Okay. Let's get to the news. We're going to begin this morning in Cuba. Yeah, he does wear that. Where at least 80 demonstrators involved with recent protests have been arrested amid the worst economic crisis the country has seen in decades. NBC News Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Andrea Mitchell has the latest.
Thousands of demonstrators spilling into the streets of Cuba this weekend, calling for an end to the 62-year communist regime. Chants of "We want freedom" echoing through the streets. Protesters dumping trash and throwing rocks. Demonstrations sparked by chronic food shortages and blackouts. In Miami, protests in solidarity with Havana.
We've been waiting for change for so long.
Maria Figueroa has family in Cuba.
I don't even know what their situation is right now.
An economic crisis exacerbated by the pandemic and no access to approved COVID vaccines. A perfect storm for anti-regime anger that spread rapidly as more Cubans recently gained access to the internet. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel today blaming the unrest on U.S. sanctions.
Al desabastecimiento de alimentos.
The lack of medicine and food, all those topics that are embedded in our society as dissatisfaction, what is the origin? It's a blockade.
They simply are not hearing the voices and will of the Cuban people. People deeply, deeply, deeply tired of the repression.
President Obama established diplomatic relations with Cuba and removed it from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. But the Trump administration put Cuba back on that list, imposing tougher sanctions, which President Biden has not lifted.
We call on the government, of Cuba, to refrain from violence and our attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba.
Andrea Mitchell reporting there. Let's go down to Havana. That's where we find reporter for NBC News, Ed Augustin. Ed, good morning. It's good to see you. So just lay out for our viewers, if you can, why exactly we're seeing these demonstrations in the streets. We've heard combinations of general repression, authoritarianism. We know economic conditions obviously contribute to that. Also COVID and the spread there and the lack of a government response to it. What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, the scenes I saw on Sunday are things that I've never witnessed in Cuba. I've been here for 8 years, and in Havana and across the country, there were thousands of people. I saw youths throwing bottles at police, ripping up paving slabs. I saw one policeman hit in the face with a cobblestone with a paving slab before having to speed off with other policemen, almost running over protesters. Police, for their part, beating protesters, firing, not sure if that was rubber bullets or not, using truncheons, batons to hit them, pepper spray. So it was a melee of violence between predominantly young protesters and youths, many of whom were rioting. A police car was upturned. I think the main driver for this has been the scarcity and privation that Cubans are living through. As you mentioned in the lead up to this, the Trump administration has hit Cuba with unprecedentedly potent sanctions, over 200 sanctions against the Cuban regime here over the Trump time in office. And those sanctions have asphyxiated the economy. The Cuban government does not have the money it needs to import the medicine that people need. It doesn't have enough money to import food. And that's playing out in the street and adding to a huge amount of tension. I spoke to a woman yesterday who gets up every morning at 3:45 in the morning, has to hide from police because there's a curfew in place to try and keep COVID limited until 5 o'clock. She hides behind a shoe repair place, a cobbler's. And then at 5 o'clock, she bolts to the queue to queue up for goods that she doesn't even know are going to arrive. Yesterday was a good day for her because she was only, she said, in the queue for 8 hours and was able to get back just before lunch with some minced meat. So it's this sort of deprivation, standing in line, that's linked, of course, not only to US sanctions, but inefficiency in the state-planned economy, and of course the pandemic, which has removed all tourism revenue for this country, that has led to this huge amount of frustration and anger that we saw explode onto streets in Cuba on Sunday.
Ed, as you know, for generations, the Cuban government has squashed very quickly any sign of dissent against it. Is this time different? Is this new generation of people that we're seeing in the streets, these demonstrators who appear to be fed up with their government, is it different this time?
I think that what we're seeing right now is the government coming down hard on the demonstrators, especially demonstrators that were violent, but also there will be some prisoners of conscience. There will be people who are arrested under house arrest or currently being interrogated because of their political beliefs. I think it's a mix. I'm speaking to you now from an island where the internet has been cut. The authorities have likely cut that, one can only surmise, to stop a repeat of the demonstrations that we saw 2 days ago. And in Havana right now, there's a very heavy police presence. I mean, just driving here on the way to work, you see an expanded police presence. So authorities here are going to be very keen to keep a lid on protests if they're able to.
All right, NBC's Ed Augustin in Havana, Cuba for us this morning. Ed, thanks so much. And Joe, of course, we heard quickly from the Cuban government that this is all because of the United States blockade of Cuba, a crutch we've heard for many generations.
It's interesting. I didn't actually see those protests in the crowd. Let's bring in White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire. Jonathan, there obviously are a lot of implications to how the Biden administration approaches this crisis, obviously diplomatic and geopolitical, but also domestic considerations as well. The Biden administration can't be seen sitting back as these protests go on 90 miles south of Florida.
No, Joe, and we heard pretty encouraging words from the president yesterday in terms of supporting these protests, supporting these demonstrators, taking, frankly, a markedly different tone than his former boss, Barack Obama, who really sought to ease tensions with Cuba, to try to sort of normalize some relationship there, even with the Castro regime. Of course, that all went away under former President Donald Trump, who really reimposed tough sanctions, many of which, some of these restrictions, the U.S. government under Biden have not yet released, have not yet changed, have not yet rolled back. I actually pressed Press Secretary Jen Psaki about that yesterday, and she pointed to other aid that had gone there. I also asked about the vaccines, which, of course, is cited as one of the issues there in Cuba. They are been ravaged by the pandemic, the economy never great to begin with, but devastated by the lack of tourism due to the pandemic. And she said that because Cuba was not part of COVAX, the International Vaccine Distribution Organization, the U.S. was not yet able to send any vaccines that way. So there's no obvious immediate solution to that. But there is the domestic front, of course. We know how powerful the voting bloc of Cubans is, particularly in Florida, particularly around Miami. We know President Biden lost Florida in 2020 by somewhat of a substantial amount. A lot of Democratic strategists actually have almost written off Florida for 24, especially if Donald Trump gets back in the race, thinking that it's just that's simply not going to come back into their column. But of course, there are Latino populations far from a monolith elsewhere in the country as well. And there are, of course, other Democrats other than Joe Biden who have political interests in Florida. So they're navigating carefully here. And in the coming days, the president has promised we'd be hearing more from him, perhaps some more concrete proposals about Cuba.
All right. Meanwhile, the White House says it is still reviewing Haiti's request to send U.S. troops to help secure its airport and other infrastructure amid the discord after the assassination of the country's president. When asked if it's been ruled out, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said no. A U.S. delegation is now in Haiti pushing for a political accord that will enable the country to have free and fair elections later this year. Now to some legal matters surrounding former President Trump. NBC News has confirmed that Alan Weisselberg, the Trump Organization chief financial officer, indicted on tax fraud charges earlier this month, has been quietly removed from top positions at more than two dozen Trump subsidiaries. But a person familiar with the matter says the executive's overall role with the Trump Organization remains the same. According to filings with the Florida State Department that were first reported yesterday by The Wall Street Journal, Weisselberg was removed from positions with at least 28 Trump subsidiaries. The Washington Post reports his removal from more than 40 subsidiaries, citing British corporate records. NBC News reports one of the companies he is no longer listed as an executive at is Trump Payroll Corp, which was hit with criminal charges on July 1st. Along with Weisselberg and the Trump Organization. Weisselberg had been on the Trump Payroll Corp, their treasurer, secretary, and vice president, those roles now filled by Donald Trump Jr., according to the filings. So Trump Jr.'s got those jobs now.
Yeah, and meanwhile, two of former President Trump's most outspoken election attorneys are facing possible sanctions for their efforts to overturn Joe Biden's win in Michigan. Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood appeared via Zoom for a federal court hearing yesterday that lasted more than 6 hours. The two filed a lawsuit in November that was littered with lies, some of which were repeated by Donald Trump himself. The pair attempted now to distance themselves from their claims, with Wood even saying in part, quote, "My name was placed on there, but I had no involvement. I did not review any of the documents." U.S. District Court Judge Linda Parker spent hours asking the attorneys to explain how closely they had reviewed and vetted information submitted in hundreds of pages of sworn declarations that they had told the court constituted evidence of purported fraud and irregularities. This all according to the Washington Post. The judge noted one observer stated in an affidavit she believed she saw election workers switching votes from Trump to Biden. Parker asked whether any of the lawyers had spoken to the witness and inquired what exactly she saw that led her to believe votes had been switched. She was greeted with silence. Anyone? She asked again. "I don't think I've really ever seen any affidavit that has made so many leaps," said the judge. Judge Parker also focused on another statement from a witness who swore he saw individuals placing clear plastic bags into a mail truck and said he believed the bags could be ballots headed for Detroit's counting facility. The judge called that allegation really fantastical and speculative. Last week, another former Trump attorney, Rudy Giuliani, had his law license suspended in Washington, D.C. for similar reasons. This was just weeks after a New York court took the same measure. Joe, this hearing in Michigan with the federal judge was extraordinary. For 6 hours, she peppered these attorneys, and it boiled down to you put into this affidavit a bunch of stuff you read online, maybe in a comment section, and tried to make a legal argument without vetting any of it.
Well, I mean, they're conspiracy theories that you can still find online, whether it's Russian disinformation or if it comes from a Chinese religious cult that has a front in the United States, and maybe conspiracy theories on Facebook, and for attorneys to actually put that into a pleading, sign their name to it. And then put it into federal court. That's really shocking, Willie, and it's shocking for anybody that's ever really practiced law. I've always joked about when I was an attorney in Northwest Florida, I do state law work, but man, when you went in federal courts, and it's something that they taught you very early on, you better get all your facts right in those federal pleadings. And again, they'd say the same thing about state pleadings, but you'd always hear about Rule 11 sanctions. They would come after you for sanctions. If it's not filed in good faith, you were going to get hammered by federal judges. I don't think there's a lawyer in America that started at a law firm where there were older attorneys that didn't give them that warning. That's one of the things that was shocking me in November and December when people, you know, Rudy Giuliani, he was filing these things, and Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell, they would file these crazy lawsuits. And I would keep wondering, how are they doing this? How can they get away with this? Because I know if this had happened in Northwest Florida in front of the three federal judges that were there when I was practicing, man, you would have lost your law license in a second. They would have disbarred you in a second. I mean, seriously, it wouldn't have been a close call. And I know I'm going on and on about this, but I just can't explain to people who aren't attorneys enough how mind-blowingly wild, how radical, how reckless, how stupid it was for these attorneys to put their names on conspiracy theories and then put them in federal court in front of federal judges. I've just wondered why it's taken this long. So, I mean, I'm not surprised by the 6 hour hearing. I guess I'm just surprised that it happened in July instead of in March. But the wheels of justice turn slowly. And perhaps these lawyers that made a mockery of these federal judges, made a mockery of federal courts, maybe they ultimately will pay the same price that every other attorney in America would pay if they did the same thing. Perhaps. Let's hope there is justice for all. And then there's this. The Republican Party's top lawyer called election fraud claims by former President Trump's legal team a, quote, joke. According to a November 28th email obtained by The Washington Post, the Republican National Committee's chief counsel, Justin Ramir, discouraged a staffer from posting claims about ballot fraud on RNC accounts. Ramir wrote to Liz Harrington, a former party spokeswoman, in part, quote, what Rudy and Gina are doing is a joke, and they're getting laughed out of court. They're getting laughed out of court. Referring to Trump attorneys Rudy Giuliani and Gina Ellis, he continues, quote, they are misleading millions of people who have wishful thinking that the president is going to win this thing. Let's bring in Pulitzer Prize winning columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post and MSNBC political analyst Eugene Robinson. Gene, When I talk to friends who are reading conspiracy websites, who are reading Facebook conspiracy websites, who are going to websites that are run by Chinese religious cults, I say, listen, Rudy Giuliani, He got laughed out of court. Rudy Giuliani never would allege in federal court widespread voter fraud. All of these judges, Trump appointed judges, laughed these people out of court in a minute. And still mm-hmm. that conspiracy theory still holds. But here is another example, is it not? Of all the institutions that may have buckled under Donald Trump, our federal court system remained strong.
Yeah, thank heavens for the federal court system, because it did remain strong throughout this entire disgraceful process. Like you, I'm surprised that this hearing didn't happen in March or April as opposed to in July. But it's really important. It's important because the federal courts are not to be trifled with just out and out lies, with rumor and comment section nonsense, the way that Rudy Giuliani and Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell did, and they are officers of the court. I mean, they are they have a responsibility and a duty not to do what they did, and I just hope that they face the most severe punishment possible, because it's just important for the nation to see this, to understand just how ridiculous, how fantastical, as the judge said, these arguments were and these pleadings were. There has to be some fact basis for this government and this nation to survive and to move forward. And the courts, thankfully, are sticking up for that principle, that there have to be facts, that there can't just be whatever you want to make up about alleged voter fraud that never took place.
Joe, you, Mika, and I have talked so much during the Trump era about the institutions holding. And in this case, we've seen again and again and again the courts around these conspiracy theories, around these ridiculous lawsuits about the election holding. And we saw that again in Michigan. The part of the damage, though, that's been done perhaps irreparably for a lot of right. people is the feeding of these conspiracy theories up to this moment. Donald Trump was at CPAC 2 days ago calling this a rigged election. A majority of Republicans believe he actually won. So the courts held. But culturally, through the media ecosystem that so many people in this country live in, they still believe that there was something afoul about that election, despite what all these courts and all these judges have said.
Well, look right. at all the people who stormed the Capitol.
Yeah, and you would have, that's because Rudy Giuliani and other of these scam artist attorneys would be outside of a courthouse and they would be spinning conspiracy theories. And then they'd go inside the courthouse and maybe they would pull back on what they were suggesting. Again, while, what was it, maybe 63 out of 64 cases, Trump lost 63 out of 64 cases there, you still had those press conferences that were still causing the damage. So, again, you can only hope that if these attorneys are sanctioned, that will make headlines and that there will be enough information that at least that will move some people. 75 million people? No. Like, I'd settle for 100,000 right now. Yeah. This is so, so crazy. And again, I pulled it up, Rule 11, just to let people know, every attorney knows about this, that by presenting to the court a pleading, written motion or other paper, an attorney or unrepresented party certifies that to the best of the person's knowledge, information, and belief formed after the inquiry, reasonable under the circumstances, it's not being presented for any improper purpose, such as to harass, cause unnecessary delay, or needlessly increase the cost of litigation. The claims, defenses, other legal contentions are warranted by existing law, or a non-frivolous argument for extending model. It goes on and says if you violate Rule 11, you will be sanctioned by the court. It's hard for me to believe that all of these attorneys not only will be sanctioned by the court, but also at some point Like Bill Clinton, after impeachment, was disbarred in Arkansas and in front of the United States Supreme Court. If these attorneys literally tried to undermine United States elections and undermine Madisonian democracy, certainly they deserve to be disbarred in front of every court that they're still able to argue in front of. It's not a close call. Let's hope again that the same justice that would apply to a lawyer on the streets of Pensacola walking to a federal courthouse will apply to these powerful attorneys who tried to subvert American democracy and overturn an election.
All right, still ahead on Morning Joe, Texas Democrats flee the state in an effort to block Republicans from passing a new voting law. We'll talk to one of those lawmakers who's now in Washington, D.C. Plus, we're digging into President Biden's plan for tackling the surge in violent crime across the country. Also this morning, a new warning about Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine. The FDA says it's been linked to a serious but rare side effect. And nominations for the 73rd annual Primetime Emmy Awards will be announced this morning, and we have some predictions. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. It is 29 past the hour. It's a beautiful day in Washington as the sun comes up over the White House. The FDA announced a new warning on the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine and a possible link to a rare neurological disorder. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez has the latest.
Among 12.8 million recipients of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, the CDC now says federal officials have identified about 100 suspected cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome. GBS is a neurological disorder in which the body's immune system damages nerve cells, causing muscle weakness or, in severe cases, paralysis.
That message about these side effects being exceptionally rare, frankly, it has not gotten through to people. And we run the risk here, if we don't pivot quickly away from J&J, of having a sustained carryover effect, really damaging the reputation and the image of the mRNA vaccines.
The GBS cases occurred about 2 weeks after receiving the J&J shot, mostly among men, many over age 50. Most people who contract GBS recover.
Still, the FDA warning is the latest blow for a vaccine that had been highly anticipated because it was easier to administer. It requires only one dose and can be stored at a higher temperature.
But in April, the CDC said it had identified rare but serious blood clots linked to the J&J vaccine. The company says it's working with federal regulators, that the chance of having this occur is very low, and that it happened only slightly more often than in a population that hadn't taken the COVID vaccine. Though the CDC says the data does not show a similar side effect for the Pfizer and Moderna shots. Despite all this, public health experts stress that vaccine benefits far outweigh the risks, as nearly all COVID hospitalizations and deaths are now occurring among the unvaccinated.
Kate Gutierrez reporting for us there. The pandemic continues to impact professional sports as well. Former British Open champion Zach Johnson tested positive for coronavirus before getting on a charter flight to the tournament, forcing him to withdraw and end his streak at 69 consecutive majors. This follows a similar decision on Sunday by reigning Masters champion Hideki Matsuyama, who cited a lack of practice following his positive test earlier this month. And with COVID protocols keeping Bubba Watson out of the field, that brings the total to 17 golfers so far who have withdrawn from the British Open, which begins on Thursday. New York Mets slugger, as we told you at the top of the show, Pete Alonso, successfully defended his home run derby crown last night in Denver.
One more to win it as Alonso comes out of the timeout and walks it off. What a finish. Alonso defends his title, the 2021 Derby champion. Put the belt on again.
Get that belt, Pete Alonso. Alonso topped the Orioles' Trey Mancini, who's a great story in his own right, recovering from cancer last year to make it to the final. Alonso, the third back-to-back Derby champ in history. As for the current Major League home run leader, the Angels' sensations, Shohei Ohtani, could not power past the first round, ousted after a second swing-off against Washington's Juan Soto, whose Derby debut included a record-setting 520-foot home run, the longest ever recorded by StatCast in that competition. The longest Derby blast believed to have been a 524-foot shot by Sammy Sosa in 2002. Ohtani's early exit means he can save a little strength for tonight's All-Star game, and he's going to need it because he will be the starting pitcher on the mound and lead off as the designated hitter for the American League. That makes Ohtani the first two-way starter in the history of the All-Star game. Joe, he's an extraordinary player. Yeah. First of all, the Derby was a blast last night, a lot of fun. But what Ohtani's doing, he's going to go out on the hill. He's going to throw 100 miles an hour. Then he's going to have to race to the dugout and get his bat and lead off. We've never seen that, even with Babe Ruth, in the history of the All-Star game.
I mean, it's really exciting. I will say, I'm not sure if Fonzie didn't jump the shark yesterday when the Wall Street Journal published a piece that said Ohtani was actually better than Babe Ruth. I mean, obviously, he played in an all-white league, and obviously he was playing in the teens and the 1920s and into the early 1930s. Still, if we're just comparing numbers, we're just comparing an arc of a career, man, I don't know who in the world you compare to Babe Ruth. It just seems from those who played in that time, Babe Ruth was the greatest hitter of all time. And if you believe people like Joe DiMaggio, Satchel Paige was the greatest pitcher of all time.
Yeah, by the time we get to October, Ohtani may have had a better single season than Ruth ever had. But obviously, you can't compare their careers. One thing to watch, though, Jonathan Lemire, as we talk about Ohtani and how great he's been for the game this year, is how long he keeps this up. Because Babe Ruth was only actually a pitcher and a hitter simultaneously for a couple of years before they realized, well, he can really hit. Let's let him focus on that once he came to New York. But watching that Derby last night brought some of the magic back, and it'll be fun to see Ohtani play tonight.
That was spectacularly fun last night, the whole thing. I'm glad you mentioned the Trey Mancini story coming back from cancer. Would you give a shout-out to Pete Alonso's batting practice pitcher? If you've seen those grids where they show you where the pitches go, every pitch was in the exact same spot, Dave Jouse. Remarkable consistency, allowing Alonso to totally lock in. But Ohtani's the story here. And I think it's interesting, Willie, because he's someone who, up until this season, the Angels have really babied. Like, when he pitched, they'd give him a couple days off before they let him hit again. They really tried to take care of him. He resulted in having Tommy John surgery a couple years ago. He's missed some time. This year, they kind of took the leash off of him. He wanted this. He wants to be able to pitch and then turn right around and hit the very next day. And so far, he's having an all-time season. And I'll just say this. There's a lot of sports media chatter yesterday about whether or not he is a good face of baseball, and some were very critical of that. Baseball is lucky to have him. He's a good guy. He's a charismatic guy. He's a superstar. And I will say, walking around streets, whether in Washington, New York, other places, you're seeing Ohtani jerseys. I mean, baseball struggled to market its stars like the NFL and NBA has, but he is a spectacular story. Let's hope he stays healthy. The numbers at the end of the season could be eye-popping.
Well, he really has emerged, especially this year, as a superstar that everybody's talking about. And it really is. Kids are absolutely riveted by him, riveted by the stories. Jack is a huge Red Sox fan, and we usually only talk all things Red Sox. Over the past several weeks, I'm hearing Otani. He was waiting. He loves Xander. He loves Devers. He loves all the Red Sox, all of them, the ones that are in the All-Star game and not. But he was looking forward to Otani. I do want to say, though, Babe Ruth, here's some lifetime statistics, Willie, that aren't too bad. Of course, we all know 714 home runs held that record for, my gosh, 40 years until Hank Aaron hit 715. Lifetime average, home runs, 714. Batting average, a cool 342 batting average. 342, a guy hitting for power like that. Runs over 2,000, RBIs over 2,000. Slugging percentage, 690. OPS, 1.16. For good luck finding anybody that's going to have 2 or 3 years back-to-back better than that, given an entire career.
That's the trick, to make a whole career out of it beyond a season. And don't forget, he did it while ordering hot dogs from his position on the field. So not the same sort of physical conditioning that we see today.
Coming up, pushing back at the narrative that Facebook simply lost its way as it became a channel for disinformation and propaganda. Our next guests reveal what they claim are dangerous flaws built into the platform by design.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
And welcome back to Morning Joe. It is 42 past the hour. Live look at Capitol Hill this morning. Social media giants Facebook and Twitter are being criticized over their failure to act quickly enough to stem the racist abuse of three black players who failed to score penalties in England's shootout loss to Italy in the European Championship final. A Facebook spokesperson said the company moved quickly to take down the racial abuse aimed at England players on its Instagram photo sharing app. Twitter removed more than 1,000 tweets and permanently suspended a number of accounts for violating its rules against harassment and hateful content. The racist abuse has led to calls for social media companies to do more in hunting down the perpetrators of the abuse. All three players targeted are part of an England squad that has been widely praised for its diversity and social conscience. British police opened investigations into the abuse on Monday.
Gene Robinson, you worked over in Britain, obviously, in London. I'm just curious what your experience was. We Americans often overgeneralize and we think of Britain, we think of Europe as being more progressive, more open, more liberal on many fronts. I've talked to business people, especially over the past several years, whenever we talk about them living in Europe, talk about them going to football matches, and they're shocked by a lot of the racism they hear from the stands, bananas being thrown out on the field at the feet of black players. And I said, what's going on there? Is that just a small segment? And they talk about at times that there really is just that sort of outright racism, but also a lot of blind spots on racial matters in Europe. What was your experience? Does this terrible chapter in football, does that surprise you?
It does not surprise me. Yes, there is a lot of racism in Europe. And there is, the difference is here in the United States, we fight about it. We talk about it. It's more sort of up front. We sort of work on it. It's a grinding, uncomfortable process. Over there, in my experience, there's much less open acknowledgement that there is a problem, that there are racial issues. In France, for example, has long sort of declined to count people, basically, to acknowledge that there are multiple racial groups in France, and the official position has always been, well, everyone is French, and there's no difference between anybody, and so we're not really going to study like disparities and inequalities in a way that we do here in the States. And so the result, in my experience, and this is anecdotal, but I think right, is that it sort of gets papered over, and then you see these eruptions particularly in the stands at football matches, but you see it elsewhere as well in the council estates, the public housing, and in England, or in the banlieue, the racially mixed suburbs of Paris. You see sort of real eruptions of a kind of racism that's always there. It's just not acknowledged as much, and therefore not dealt with. And I ultimately, mm-hmm. from all my time abroad and in Europe and in South America, I came to think that our way of dealing with these issues is better. It's much less comfortable. It's a pain for all of us. It's difficult. It's not fun, but it actually does get us further, I think.
Yeah, we talk through it. You know, it was first woke, and then that battle, another network was talking about, and they change every 3 months. Now it's critical race. But we talk about it, we debate it. Sometimes, like you said, it's uncomfortable, but the debate's always out there, and it always has been out there. I mean, I'm just talking about, I'm thinking about my experience that I told you about, like, you know, we integrated in Mississippi in 1969. They're battles. They're constant battles going on. But we talk about it publicly. Willie, a lot of times, you know, and it's not just people from projects in the stands in an England match that do this. I've had business people that have been in boardrooms that have been shocked, again, by the insensitivities. And I'm not saying this as a negative statement generally towards Europe. I'm just saying there are blind spots there that we Americans wouldn't normally associate, again, with countries that are often considered to be far more progressive, far more, some Americans would think, advanced socially than the United States of America. Blind spots. But we certainly saw it after the England match. But we also saw a beautiful outpouring. Like, for instance, we showed the Marcus Rashford mural that had been defaced. It's now turned into this wonderful tribute, not only to him, but that great England team. And, man, what about Gareth Southgate? That guy really has shown dignity and class through this entire process. So a real person for that nation to look up to.
Yeah, England's coach putting responsibility all on him, trying to take some of the heat off the three players who are getting so much of it, particularly on Facebook. Let's talk more about Facebook with New York Times reporters Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang. They're out with a new book today titled An Ugly Truth Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Good morning to you both. Congratulations on Pub Day. We were talking earlier, there have been so many books written about Facebook. The question is, what else can you say? It turns out there's a lot more to say inside your book. So, Shira, let me start with you. And we can talk about the insurrection of January 6th. We can talk about the attack on the Capitol. and how much of that poison, how many of those conspiracy theories collected and gathered steam on Facebook. And as you both write in the book, this is a feature of Facebook, that the platform is effectively created to get people engaged at whatever cost.
Absolutely. I mean, we could see for months leading up to January 6th that movements that called themselves Stop the Steal were spreading this incredibly emotive content, which was designed to misinform people and tell them that the election had been stolen from President Trump. And these groups were going viral. They were spreading this misinformation. It was being amplified by the president itself. Facebook saw that happening, and while they did take action on some groups, there were many other groups that they left online.
So Facebook will tell you, yeah, we took down the posts. Any time we saw violence or a threat, we took it down. How seriously do they take this stuff, conspiracy theories? And are they compelled, because as you say, it does go against their business model, are they compelled really to go after them, Cecilia?
I mean, they're trying. They're hiring thousands of content moderators or expanding their security team. But this is a company with 3 billion users. So they're really playing catch up. The gap is so wide between what they can enforce. What we found in our book and our reporting really surprised us in that we thought that this company was like a Frankenstein, perhaps a machine that had kind of gotten out of control. But what we found is, as you said, Willie, there was actually it's a feature, not necessarily a bug, that engagement is the core thing that they're looking for. And that means eyeballs constantly there, checking back over and over and coming frequently. Mm-hmm.
So here's a spokesman for Facebook released a statement about the claims the company didn't do enough to stop the January 6th Capitol attack, writing, quote, as we've said repeatedly, including before Congress, our teams were vigilant in removing content that violated our policies against inciting violence leading up to January 6th. We were prepared for this. We've been more aggressive than any other internet company in combating harmful content, including content that sought to delegitimize the election. We banned hundreds of militarized social movements, took down tens of thousands of QAnon pages, groups, and accounts from our apps, removed the original Stop the Steal group, labeled candidates' posts that sought to prematurely declare victory, and suspended former President Trump from our platform for at least 2 years. So, Shira, let's talk about the bigger question that's surrounded Facebook for years. Are they a publisher? Are they a platform? In other words, if they're a platform, they just say, we're opening the gate for a bunch of people to gather here. We're not responsible legally, certainly, but really generally for what happens on our platform. Have they changed in that view at all?
I mean, Facebook, it's the smartest business move they can make to see themselves as a neutral platform because it absolves them of any responsibility. And that's something that we saw Mark Zuckerberg establish in the very earliest years of the platform. And he's continued to hold that position because it's the right one for him business-wise. But I think anyone looking at the company right now can say, well, you're neither. You're not purely a media company. You're not purely a neutral platform. You're something else. And we have to start defining that, because until we do, you're not going to hold yourself responsible, and the government is going to struggle to hold you responsible.
Joe's got a question for you. Joe?
Yeah, you know, I saw that. Listen to that statement from Facebook. And, you know, they set the fire, and then they brag about putting the fire out. But the fire continues to spread while they keep setting other fires. And I'm just wondering what you all, when you hear that statement, and then you think back to the Black Lives Matter protest, and you think back to the federal agent that was assassinated in Oakland by somebody associated with the Boogaloo Boys, and suddenly people started to look and see what Facebook did. If you decided to go on a page for self-defense, or let's say a very conservative website, They suddenly start directing you towards pages of right-wing fanatics, Boogaloo Boys, et cetera, et cetera. And isn't it the algorithms that push people in more radical directions, which then causes violence? And then they go, oh, we clean it up. When in fact, they're the ones that, like you said, are driving engagement, even if that means pushing people to extremist sites.
Yeah, Joe, the algorithms and the many tools that they have are all designed to boost engagement, to get people to engage more with the site. And that means pushing people into groups where you have like-minded people who are oftentimes pushing conspiracy theories in the most far right and the most dangerous sort of rhetoric that's occurring in these groups that are also harder to patrol by this company. When I heard that statement, I was thinking, this is a real whack-a-mole approach they have, and they are taking credit for things that they've done, and they have done these things. But in this whack-a-mole, the hammer they have is so small compared to what they're up against. And the scale of what Facebook is at, I mean, they've created something that has been such a megaphone for harmful content and information.
Sure, there's a great piece of reporting in there where Facebook considers on January 6th whether Mark Zuckerberg himself should call the president of the United States and say, what are you doing about this? Despite the fact that all these people, many of them gathered on Facebook and Facebook had a hand in this, what was the calculation to not ultimately make that phone call?
They were afraid that it was going to leak to the press. I mean, one of the interesting things about Facebook as a company and the reason we were really able to report this book is that finally people within the company are speaking up. They're calling reporters such as myself and Cecilia and trying to blow the whistle on what they see internally. And in this case, they said, well, if we have him call Trump, it's probably going to leak to reporters and it's going to look like we were proactive. It's going to look like we were somehow in concert with this, and better not to do it in order to avoid that.
Facebook released a statement on this as well, whether its executives considered that phone call to President Trump, writing, no such discussion took place with Mark. Nobody suggested he call, and he didn't. If Trump ignored the pleas of his own vice president, the idea that Mark Zuckerberg could have influenced him is absurd. That's the statement from Facebook. Cecilia, let's just talk about what changes now. As you write in the book, this is one of the most successful companies in the history of the world, started as a dorm room project 17 years ago at Harvard. And now it has such control, it has such influence, it has such power. Why would they be compelled to change?
Well, and we don't think that any change would necessarily come from within. There's really nobody that has oversight over the most powerful person within the company, who is Mark Zuckerberg. It's really unusual, the structure at Facebook, where Mark Zuckerberg has so much control over decisions and the stock. So, you know, interestingly, when a court threw out a lawsuit that was the biggest impediment to Facebook's growth, an antitrust lawsuit, the company's stock soared, and the company was valued at $1 trillion after that news break.
It's extraordinary. And there's so much new reporting in this book, a story we thought we've understood fully. It turns out there's much more to it. Thanks to the new book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira Frenkel and Cecilia Kang, thank you both and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Joe? Hmm.
Gene, Shira and Cecilia were talking about how Facebook would talk about all they were up against in trying to chase down all these extremists online. Well, what they're up against is an algorithm. What they're up against is a Frankenstein monster that they have created themselves. And they refuse to have any meaningful oversight. Zuckerberg refuses to have any meaningful oversight. Their lies that they let spread on their platform have led to anti-vax conspiracy theories. My family members constantly calling, asking about plandemic, something that, you know, Facebook spread at the height of the pandemic, suggesting Anthony Fauci killed people in AIDS trials and that he was going to become a billionaire because of this. They allowed lies to spread during the Black Lives Matters protests that led to the assassination of a federal officer in Oakland. They spread lies that led to January the 6th. I mean, they are the conduit for these lies. They publish these lies every day, and it's their algorithms that push it. What they're up against is what they've created and what they refuse to regulate. And American democracy and the health of Americans is what's put at risk because of their recklessness in chasing a $1 trillion valuation.
Right. And my question is, what do they do now? Because you're right, this whack-a-mole approach is never going to work with 3 billion users out there and an algorithm that that boosts engagement in ways that, as we've seen, are damaging and harmful and sometimes violent. What do they need? A million people to vetting content instead of the tens of thousands that they have now? Do they need a sort of Uber algorithm that regulates the algorithm itself? Something big needs to be done to this company that is, or with this company that is now so big and so influential. 3 billion users, that's a substantial portion of the people on the planet. And it just strikes me that it's out of their control and out of our control. And it's very difficult for any of us, including them, I think, to get our arms around this phenomenon now. So you could call it Frankenstein's monster or whatever. But, you know, a few 10,000 content moderators is not going to make a difference.
No, and for a company that's now valued at $1 trillion, they can hire a hell of a lot more. Eugene Robinson, thank you so much.
Thanks,
greatly appreciate you being with us as always, and just your just important insights. Greatly appreciate it. But you know, if they can't control it, if it's got, which by the way is just garbage, they can control it. They can fix the algorithm so the algorithms don't push people.
They can do anything they want.
Extremes. They can do whatever they want. They just don't want to do anything. They want to keep making money. But if the argument is, oh, this is too big for us to handle, then it goes back to what I've said before. They need to be broken up into a million pieces. They are a monopoly. They are stopping other companies from coming into the market. They are stifling competition. They are crushing entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, the Facebooks of the future. So why aren't they broken into pieces just like the Bells were broken in? Bell Telephone was broken into pieces back as they continued to grow in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. If it weren't for the fact that Bell was broken up, then we wouldn't have cell phones. We probably wouldn't have cell phones. Bell controlled everything, absolutely everything. So the federal government, actually, they did something pretty radical. They actually applied antitrust laws to break up the Bells, and we are all better off for it. And I'm just seeing what's going on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. You just hear the sloshing of money going around for Republicans and Democrats alike. Facebook just passing out thousands and thousands of dollars to Congress people, to senators, trying to do anything they can do to stop actually being held accountable and trying to stop antitrust laws that were put in place to stop companies like this, to stop them from continuing to damage American democracy, continuing to damage a free press, continuing to damage America's health care, continuing to spread lies and claiming, oh, it's just too big for us. It's just too big. We actually were probably the main promoters at Facebook of what happened on January the 6th. Sure, we've probably led to millions and millions of Americans not trusting vaccines because of the lies that Facebook spread. Sure, but we just can't control it. Okay, federal government, do your job. Mm-hmm. Apply the antitrust laws that are on the books and apply them the way they're supposed to be applied, the way they were written.
Yeah.
I mean, because at the end of the day, yes, American democracy is being hurt. America's health is being damaged. But at the end of the day, if you give a damn about the free market, if you believe like me in the invisible hand of capitalism, if you believe in the idea that young people, young entrepreneurs should be able to start a company in their garage and grow it into something like, oh, I don't know, Microsoft, which is exactly what happened. Well, then you want to break these monopolies up. And the tech monopolies keep getting bigger by the day. They keep getting more powerful by the day. They keep getting more dangerous by the day. But again, forget that. Let's just talk about American capitalism. They block the entrance to thousands and thousands of new entrepreneurs, new small business owners, new people with new ideas that could create thousands and thousands of jobs and make this economy stronger and make this country more vital and make our tech industry more cutting edge, even more cutting edge, instead of just having these plodding five or six monopolies that we're still allowing to rule over the earth like dinosaurs. Enough is enough, Congress. Do your job.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.